Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida wildlife officials are working to fight a bacteria attacking the state's coral, but officials say isolating the cause of the disease is difficult.
There is no smoking gun that we can point to.
The separation of undocumented immigrant parents from their children may have ended, but the controversy continues.
We have 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States, and we don't know what percentage of them are applying for asylum.
Plus, a conversation on education with billionaire gubernatorial candidate Jeff Green, a young Florida rapper takes his anti-drug message to the Florida Capitol, and in Florida, sunscreen isn't just a summertime thing. That's ahead on Capitol Report. Good evening. I'm Lynn Hatterin for Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Welcome to tonight's show. Hurricanes and warming ocean waters have damaged Florida's coral reefs over the years, but as Regan McCarthy reports, now experts say the state's corals are facing a new danger, an especially pervasive bacteria.
A few years ago, scientists began to see white marks showing up on coral off Florida's coast, indicating some of the tissue had died.
Here you can see a smaller coral with the lesions starting here at the very bottom of the coral. And then just a month, or actually, 2 weeks later, it has encompassed about a third of this coral as the lesion is just moving up. And then here, just a couple more weeks, it's already encompassed half of this coral. So this is an extremely rapid rate of progression that let us know this was not something like bleaching. This was not your typical coral diseases that we've documented in the past.
That's Rob Ruzica with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Research Institute. He updated FWC commissioners on the issue during their recent meeting. Ruzica says scientists first noticed the lesions in 2014 near Miami-Dade County. By 2016, the disease was impacting coral in Palm Beach County and the Upper Keys and continuing to spread. Then last year, Hurricane Irma hit.
As you can tell, it's encompassed now about two-thirds of the entire Florida reef track, and it's slowly making its way westward towards Key West. Hurricane Irma was a major issue with the spread of this disease because it stirred up the water, and the mechanisms for transporting the pathogen across was certainly became convoluted because it had followed this steady pattern of moving westward slowly but surely to the Middle Keys through 2017. But now it's popping up on reefs in isolated areas.
Officials are working to identify the source of the bacteria, but John Hunt with the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute and Marine Fisheries Management says it's difficult to narrow down the exact cause.
We can point to a series of coincident events that happened at the time the disease became noticed.
For example, Hunt says at that time a dredging project was underway. It was also summer and water temperatures were warmer, stressing the coral, and evidence of the disease was first found near a sewage outfall. And Joanna Walczak with the Department of Environmental Protection says since the coral was facing so many stressors at once, even something minor could have been devastating.
I always liken it to being a human. If you're eating bad food, drinking bad water, and breathing bad air, a little cut can land you in the hospital and could potentially lead to your death, and it's the same thing.
But Walczak says it's important to try to reverse the damage. She says coral plays an essential role in the environment, as well as the economy and human health.
This is a $6 billion annual income to South Florida, sales and income alone. That is not valuing the over $100 million in shoreline protection that we get from the flood reduction. Coral reefs are literally our first line of defense. They are breaking the energy that hits our beaches. And if we really care about South Florida's real estate and beaches, we should be really caring about the preservation of our coral reefs.
Walczak says coral reefs also provide a habitat for the fish we eat. And she says scientists have even found cancer and anti-inflammatory treatment drugs in coral reef organisms. During the FWC meeting, scientists said they hoped working to improve coral habitats and replant reefs with nursery-grown coral would help to rebuild the damaged reefs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Earlier this week, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson and Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz were denied entry into a federal detention facility in Homestead. It's housing an estimated 1,000 minors who were separated from their parents at the U.S. border with Mexico. Less than 24 hours later, President Trump signed an executive order ending his administration's family separation policy, which, until that point, he had adamantly denied even existed. As WGCU's Rachel Iacovone reports, the end of the policy separating children from their families in the future does not necessarily mean the reunification of those already separated families right now.
That was the most disappointing, or maybe one of the most disappointing things about the president's executive order. It was completely silent on what's going to happen to the thousands of children who have already been separated from their parents.
That's Sarah Pierce, a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. MPI is a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank that compiles migration data, amongst other things. Its compiling of the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey data is how we know, for example, there are an estimated 610,000 unauthorized immigrants in Florida, or 3% of the general state population.
We have 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States, and we don't know what percentage of them are applying for asylum.
Pierce says what they do know is that about 20% of people apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border express fear of returning home. Determining whether or not that fear is credible is how asylum is ultimately granted. Amian Kaku is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida. He says the route to asylee status has recently changed under the Trump administration's self-proclaimed zero-tolerance policy for border-crossing offenses.
It introduces criminal proceedings in all cases so that people who are seeking asylum are essentially deterred. So it's a very deliberately cruel interpretation of the law.
I'm not sure that you can say it's actually been interpreted differently.
That's Pierce again, talking about the frequently name-dropped and often under-explained Flores settlement. So let's back up.
The Flores settlement is a 1997 settlement that was the culmination of 10 years of litigation regarding how we treat unaccompanied children.
So basically, if a minor crosses the border, the United States can't hold them in the questionable circumstances they had been in some facilities in the 90s. In fact, they can't hold them in any facilities at all for more than 20 or so days, thanks to the Flores settlement.
That certainly applied to unaccompanied minors, and in practice, it also applied to their parent.
There's a but coming.
This administration has been expressing a lot of frustration because in 2015 and 2016, a series of court decisions came down saying that the Flores settlement applies not only to unaccompanied child migrants, but also to accompanied children, so children who had arrived in family units at the border.
So it's not the interpretation of the law that's changed.
What seems to be different about this administration is how they're expressing the different ways their hands are tied.
Immediately following his signing of the executive order putting a stop to the family separation policy, Trump said the no-tolerance policy still stands. So where does that leave the children who have already been separated from their families? Or the ones coming in? Will they be detained for criminal processing too now? The resounding answer so far has been,
I have no idea. We have no idea.
I'm Rachel Iacovone in Fort Myers.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a young Florida rapper recognized by the Attorney General is hoping to spread his anti-drug message.
My brain always great. My brain working fast. If you get on drugs, it's stopping all of that. Say no to drugs. Be drug free.
Florida's Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls have been talking education. Now the only billionaire in the race is making it a cornerstone of his platform.
I didn't think it was possible for 1970 that we could actually be worse off in education, be doing a worse job for our children 48 years later. But we are.
And in Florida, sunscreen isn't just for summers. It can also prevent cancer.
So you would expect that the highest risk of melanoma would be teenagers that are in the sun, playing, doing sports. But it's not the case. The reason is because it takes many years to develop melanoma.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Lynn Hatterin for Tom Flanagan. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jeff Green entered the race barely 3 months before the primary. Now the billionaire real estate titan is coming out strong on education. In a recent interview with WFSU's Ryan Daly, Green called for 2 years of public pre-kindergarten and talked of charter schools.
I was interested to know why, you know, where your passion for education comes from.
Well, I think I should start by giving you a little something about my background. I mean, I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's you know, a great working class town, lots of factories, shoe factories, textile mills. My dad was a textile machinery dealer, and we grew up middle class. He had his own business, and my mom was pretty much a stay at home mom. She taught religious school once a week, just you know, because she enjoyed doing it. And what happened in the late '60s? All the textile mills just closed. They all moved to the South. And so my dad lost his livelihood, and he had all his money in his business. So he really lost everything. We ended up selling our home. I think they just paid off the mortgage barely. And he moved to West Palm Beach. My parents moved to West Palm Beach. And it was very tough. My dad ended up getting a vending route just to make ends meet. He drove a van around. And it was hard, grueling work. And my mom took a job as a waitress at the Breakers Hotel just to make ends meet. And I remember seeing her come back at midnight, exhausted. So I understand what Florida families are going through. And to circle back to education, when my parents moved to West Palm Beach in 1970, I didn't come with them because I was told that the schools aren't that great. You know, if everyone knew that, and I was in the public schools, and I was going to public schools in Worcester. And so I decided to stay with my great aunt. I was 15 years old. My parents went with my little brother, and I stayed all by myself with a great aunt to finish high school there. And fast forward 48 years later, we are now 40th in the country, according to U.S. News & World Report, in education, K-12 education. So what we have to show from 20 years of Republican governors is I didn't think it was possible for 1970 that we could actually be worse off in education, be doing a worse job for our children 48 years later. But we are. And so we need some big, bold moves to turn that around.
So if you had to kind of lay out your education platform, I guess, what does that look like?
Well, Ryan, I'm glad you asked that question, because the great thing about education is there are examples all over the country. Now, New Jersey was in the 30s, and right now it's top five in the country. I think it's three in the country. And what they did was a few simple things. They implemented pre-K education for 3 and 4 year olds, universal, 100% paid for all 3 and 4 year olds. My wife and I started a school in West Palm Beach 2 years ago because we were frustrated with the public and private school options, and we have 3 little kids, 4, 6, and 8 years old. And so I became kind of an accidental educator. I've learned a fair amount about this, and one thing you learn very early on is that prior to third grade, kids learn to read. After third grade, kids read to learn. So it's really such a critical turning point in the third grade. If kids aren't reading in the third grade, it's very hard then to learn all their other subjects. One critical thing, as I said, is 2 years of pre-K education. Because what happens is kids get to kindergarten in Florida, and they're just not prepared. You know, if you look at, Warren Buffett, who I've gotten to know from the Giving Pledge, calls it the ovarian lottery. And he just says, you know, some kids are just born it's not their fault. They're born into a family that lives in a district that doesn't have the resources, to provide a great any pre-K at all for them. They live in a household with a single parent who may be working, one, two jobs and is not home reading to the child. So So what do you do as a state? If I'm the governor of Florida, what am I going to do to make sure that every child in kindergarten is at least at the same starting line? How am I going to do that? 2 years of pre-K education for every child.
And you briefly mentioned the school you founded, the Green School in West Palm Beach. Can you tell me a little more about the school's model?
It's just a school that basically, someone like the guy, Jeff Green, and his wife, Macy, who have been blessed with enormous wealth, decided to fund to try to do an innovation school that really tries new and exciting things in education. You know, we're funding the whole thing. I mean, the students, basically, it's need blind, so kids pay whatever their family can afford. So, you know, some kids pay the full tuition, which is as much as $26,000 a year, and some kids pay zero. And the local Palm Beach superintendent has been there a number of times and has really has looked at some of our design, the way we've designed the school and our curriculum, and I think is looking at some of the things we're doing for their own district. Unfortunately, a lot of the things in the public schools today are, dictated by testing and rigid curriculums, and we're able to have a much more free-flowing curriculum.
I understand there's sort of a business bend to the curriculum at the Green School. How do you teach business to kids coming up in today's business climate, being an increasingly service economy and things like automation now being a concern?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, look, there's an Oxford study that came out that basically shows that 45% of all jobs today will be automated within, I think, 20 years. So the reality is my kids who are 4, 6, and 8 years old will be entering the economy in the, 20 years from now. So it could be, 2000, mid to mid-2030s. I think what's going to happen is even FSU graduates today, odds are going to have lots and lots of jobs over their careers. The idea of going to work at one place, saying they're 50 years and getting a gold watch, I think is going to be in the ancient history books. And really what's going to happen is people are going to have to learn to adapt as AI, machine learning, big data, robotics, and just the exponential growth of technology continues to assault the workforce, and it's going to happen. I mean, if the people own retail stores, for 100 years, I think we just woke up one day and there was Amazon, and 5 years later they were out of business. And I think it's happening in our economy a lot, and we can't, we can't fear it. We can't fear technology. So again, I would say that teaching kids today, they have to learn math, science, reading, all the basics, have a love of learning so they love and enjoy continuing to educate and train themselves as the work environment evolves.
All of the four other candidates in the running right now in the Dem gubernatorial race have all gone after charter schools as competition for traditional public schools. Do you have a position on that? And, how do you feel about charter schools, particularly in Florida?
Well, we don't have enough funding for our public schools right now, and we have so much work to fix them, and that has to be our first priority. I mean, the priority is of the, I don't think that states and the government, the governor should be encouraging the demise of our public schools. We're doing the opposite. We need to fix our public schools, do everything we can to make our schools world class. If somebody like me wants to go out and as a private citizen and use their money to build a school and not take any money from anyone else, sure, do it. I mean, because we need everyone. Look, educating our kids is the number one priority as far as I'm concerned. We want to reduce the population in prisons. We want to, how are you going to do that? You're going to get educated population, not just in, K-12. I mean, we need to think in terms of community colleges, and these community colleges should be need blind. I mean, if you can't make someone who loses their job and has nowhere to go, they can't then afford, how can they pay tuition? They need to be able to go to take classes at no charge and, get their career going again. So I think, but in the K-12 space, I absolutely don't believe in public funding charter schools. I think it just doesn't make sense. It's not about, I know what they're saying, let's have competition, but you know what? We have to fix what we have first.
That was Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly speaking with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jeff Green. For many Floridians, slathering on the sunscreen isn't just a summer thing or a beach thing. It's an everyday, all-year-round thing. And for good reason. The American Cancer Society estimates nearly 8,000 cases of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, will be diagnosed in Florida this year alone. Member station WLRN's Christine DeMatte interviews Dr. Mike Kusner, an oncologist with Miami's Mount Sinai Medical Center.
For many Floridians, slathering on the sunscreen when you know you're going to spend a lot of time outdoors isn't just a summer thing or a beach thing. It's an everyday, all-year-round thing. Not protecting oneself from the sun's harmful UV rays causes premature aging and more serious skin diseases. And the American Cancer Society estimates that nearly 8,000 cases of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, will be diagnosed in Florida this year alone. With us in the studio is Dr. Mike Kusner, an oncologist with Miami's Mount Sinai Medical Center. Doctor, it's great to have you on.
My pleasure.
First, Dr. Kusner, what is melanoma?
Melanoma is a type of skin cancer. It's probably the deadliest form of skin cancer, a malignancy that evolves from the cells that give pigment to the skin.
Who is most at risk for melanoma, and at what age?
It's been changing. The biggest risk of melanoma, we think that it would be the people that would be kind of like in their sun worship years. So you would expect that the highest risk of melanoma would be teenagers that are on the sun, playing, doing sports. But it's not the case. The reason is because it takes many years to develop melanoma. So the recurrent burns that we may be getting now at younger ages may come back to haunt us later on in life.
What are the current treatments for more advanced cases of melanoma?
So the main treatments nowadays are still some of the chemotherapies for a selected group of patients, as well as the new immunotherapies. That's been the most important development, and it's been where the biggest advance and benefit has been seen over the past several years.
Immuno-oncology. How is it done?
It's mostly with medications. And they could be, usually most of them are given as an injection. Still is an intravenous injection in a lot of the cases. And it's usually given in a way that we could enhance our own immune system, given on an injection every 2-3 weeks, depending on the drug that is being used.
So if I understand correctly, traditional chemotherapy is structured to attack the cancer. Immunotherapy, immuno-oncology, pumps up the immune system to better fight the cancer. Is that correct?
Correct. So the way that the chemotherapy works is by killing directly the cancer cells. The immunotherapy just removes the blockage of the immune system so that the immune system is the one that kills the cancer cells.
Dr. Kusner, what would you say is the biggest healthcare myth related to skin cancer?
That sunblock will be sufficient. The biggest myth is that if you use sunblock and if you use it sporadically, it's sufficient. Not all the sun rays are completely blocked and not all the sunblocks are created equal. So the biggest myth is truly that you could prevent it 100% if you're just careful. I think that you still have to be observant, and you have to know that in several cases, even if you're the most preventive person, have the skin covered all the time, you still have the risk of any of these lesions and should not lower your guard if you see any suspicious area.
And clear something up for me. Even on a cloudy day, it's possible to get sun damage?
Oh, there is no doubt about it. There's one of the most interesting statistics in this country is that even though that we have a country that is mostly outside of the tropics, probably here in South Florida, we're the only ones in the tropics, for many years, the cloudy states had higher incidence of melanoma than what we had here in Florida. You're talking that states like Michigan, Arkansas had some years higher incidence of melanoma than Florida. And the reason is just because even on cloudy days, you still could get sun damage.
We've been talking with Dr. Mike Kusner, an oncologist with Miami's Mount Sinai Medical Center. I'm Christine DeMatte.
And finally tonight, one of Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi's top priorities is cracking down on drugs. During a recent Florida cabinet meeting, Bondi invited a young rapper to spread a similar anti-drug message. Sasha Cordner has more.
That's Curtis Bean Jr. rapping one of his songs, Wanna Be Somebody, which has already received thousands of views online. His rap name is Kid Bala, and the 8-year-old boy came to Wednesday's cabinet meeting as a guest of Attorney General Pam Bondi.
I met Curtis at Drug Free America Foundation, and this is an 8-year-old who not only is on honor roll at Bethune Academy in Haines City, but also is a rapper. He has a positive message thanks to his parents. His mom and dad are incredible. And they show kids that it's okay to be anti-drugs, to be positive about grades.
And that's just showing the kids that, just giving them another look at life. You know, it's different rap music out there, you know, and coming up the positive way, you know.
That's right.
So.
That's Curtis Bean Sr., the father of Curtis Bean Jr. He's also a rapper known as Bala Bean, who helps write the songs his son performs. To a standing ovation, Curtis Bean Jr. performed his anti-drug song for the Florida cabinet.
Say no to drugs. Yes, be drug free. I love sports and reading class. We say no to drugs to accomplish that. I'm the future. I got big dreams. Yeah, I'm only 8, but I got big dreams.
And at a time when the state as well as the nation is facing an opioid epidemic, Bondi as well as Governor Rick Scott commended Curtis Bean Jr. for his work.
Thank you, Curtis. With all the 175 people dying a day in this country, and this is what's going to change it when we start with 8-year-olds spreading a positive message. Thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations. You're doing a good job.
And the young rapper's music can be heard on his father's YouTube channel, Bala Bean. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.